Hey, good morning, everyone. It's Dave Weiner here. It is Friday, August 12th, 2016. Today, I want to talk about programming languages, operating systems, and, what got me started on this was a friend of mine, Alan Wirfs-Brock. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's a hyphenated name. Wirfs is the first part. Brock is the second part. Alan is a very accomplished programmer. He was the technical editor of the ECMAScript 6 spec. And I'm going to see Alan in Portland next week. And I actually hope to do a podcast with him. So you'll be hearing from him soon enough, if all goes well. Anyway, I saw in his tweet stream a tweet. Still, after all these years, I have trouble saying the word tweet without thinking I'm being really silly. But it was hashtag first seven langs, and he then listed his first seven programming languages. And so I thought, wow, well, this would be kind of interesting. Let me try doing it. And the funny thing about it was it took me three revs to actually get the list in an order. I still don't know if it's in the right order because my memory isn't that good from going all the way back to the mid-1970s. That's when I started programming. And it was the order of things and what, you know. And so what I decided to do was to leave out the minor experiments. You know, I only included languages that I actually developed production code in, to the extent that an 18-year-old in the mid-70s was actually generating production code, because the tools back then were so primitive that it wouldn't qualify today. But it was still a lot of work. And so it was more, I guess, in terms of commitment to the language that I was trying to reflect. Because I did some programming in PL1, and I did some programming in SQL, and even COBOL, actually, believe it or not. But those didn't lead to anything. And, they were more experiments just to just to find out what the languages were like. You know, I think early in your career, it's a good idea to try out a lot of different approaches. I tried Lisp, and then, what happened was I hit C, and at that point, I paused for a couple of years, actually, and realized that, C was sort of where I realized how much more a programming language could be than the earlier one. So here's the list. Let me just go ahead and give you the list. The first language was Fortran, Basic, Simula, PDP-11 assembly language, C. See, that's wrong. No, wait. No, it's right. God, you see how the brain doesn't work. It's right. It's right. My brain just went weird. Let's try it again. Fortran, Basic, Simula, PDP-11 assembly language, C, UCSD Pascal, and 6502 assembler. And there were, of course, more languages after that. But not many more, actually, I have to say. Because after that I went to Microsoft Pascal, and then MPW Pascal, and then ThinkC. Spent a number of years working in ThinkC, and then I switched over into Frontier and its language UserTalk, and it's the language I designed and implemented. And I designed and implemented it with the goal that this is going to be the language I'm going to spend my career in. And so I, felt at that point that I understood languages enough, and I understood, I had strong feelings about what was missing in all of the languages, that we could go further. And Frontier did that. But I'm getting ahead of myself, because today what I wanted to talk about was C, and how C, what C did for me, and I think for most of the programmers many of the programmers of my generation, let's just say that, because there were obviously a lot of experiences that people had, and there were, you know, at least two different schools, and then sub-schools. There were the Lisp guys, and they were they looked at it very differently. I had friends who were Lisp guys, and you know, we talked about systems, you know, the way, you know, you talk about them with anyone, right? But at the level of the language, it's a completely different sort of thing. It's foreign to me, and it never made sense to me. Felt like it was too much work, and I just loved C. And because I had spent, you know, time, Fortran, an awful language, let's be clear, but understandably an awful language because it was a version 1.0. It was the first high-level language, really, and so there were all kinds of things that were tacked on as annexes that were absolutely essential parts of the language. But when they started, they didn't know that they were, and so they had to be tacked on because the rules, you know, allowed a certain generality where they wanted to, you know, provide some additional functionality, so they had to overlay things in awkward ways. For example, they didn't fully get types at the beginning, you know, data types, and so they wanted to have an integer type because it was a formula language. That's what the idea was, formula translation. It was for scientific stuff, but it ended up getting used for everything because it was really the only high-level language. Now, of course, that's not true. There were others, but it was a very important, let's put it, it was a very important high-level language. And so it ended up getting used for all these other things. And so floating point values were very important, but not everything is a floating point value. And floating point is not only less efficient than integers, it's also not accurate. I mean, there's errors in floating point numbers, and integers, you know, unless you overflow, there's no errors. You know, if I take I and add 1 to it, I'm always going to get I plus 1, right? Until I get to the upper bound of the machine, which point, you know, do I get an error or do I get overflow? Well, you know, usually that's not something you worry about a whole lot. And if you have to worry about it, then you have to allow for it, right? But so Fortran had a convention that if a variable name began with an I, a J, or K, I think that was it. I don't know where it ended. Maybe it was just I and J. If it began with I and J, for sure, those were integers. And so that's why a lot of your loops, if you see a for loop in a JavaScript app, it goes for I equals 0, I less than length of the string, I plus plus. The reason it's called I is because it goes all the way back to Fortran. Fortran said that, you know, anything began with an I was an integer. Yeah. Stupid, right? No. It was just because they didn't know that they were going to have types when they started out. And so, and basic was a lot better in some ways than Fortran. It was the immediacy, the fact that you typed your code at a command line and pressed return and it ran right away. It's the precursor of consoles. It was an interpretive language. It was real time. And but it had all the basic functions of a modern language, but not in a very modern package. And let's see. Then I moved over to Algol-like languages, and this is where the light bulb started going on for me. It was like, at first I was really upset. And it was Simula was not the first Algol-like language, but one of the very first, one of the very first ones. Algol, of course, was the first Algol-like language. And Simula was, what does it mean to be Algol-like? Let's start there. JavaScript is Algol-like. Python is. Java certainly is. It means that it has a certain set of basic features. It has logic, it has looping, it has procedures, it has variables, sometimes there are structs, so you can you know, build aggregate objects out of the basic types of the language, and those can be built any number of different levels, and maybe it even has objects, so the structs can include code, and they can subclass each other. As all these sorts of things are very much Algol-like concepts, and so C++ might be the sort of like, okay, too much Algol-like. Or anyway, so Simula was my first Algol-like language, and at first I really resented that it was not like Fortran. I already know how to do this, and why do they do it differently? But it was pretty obvious after a very short period of time that you could do a lot more with this than you could with Fortran, because what would happen with Fortran programs is that they would quickly get too complicated to follow. And there would be sort of a point, there is always a point in a program at which you can't add any more functionality because you no longer understand how the whole thing works. I mean, that could happen with the most well-designed piece of software you've ever made. Just step away from it for a few months and come back. And if it has a certain level of complexity to it, you're going to have to spend some time getting back up to speed. And, you know, hopefully, now that's assuming it's well designed, but once you start adding features on top of something that you no longer understand, that's generally sort of when you're starting to go down the other side. And you're no longer really building anymore. You're no longer adding value. You're sort of subtracting it. Because while you're adding features, you're completely making it less maintainable to the point where it is no longer maintainable. And you hit that point much faster in Fortran or BASIC because they lack structural concepts. They don't have a concept of program structure. The programs actually have structure, but the structure is only appreciated by the human being. That you don't have a way of communicating the structure to the interpreter or to the compiler. But Algol changed that. Algol had the idea of compound statements, and so a statement could contain other statements within it, as deeply nested as as were the capabilities of the machine. At some point, you're going to run out of stack space. And so maybe the limit is like 800 levels deep. It's always much more than your mind can comprehend. So it's never really an effective limit. I've never really seen that. You know, I've never gotten an error. Well, take it back. Actually, I have probably gotten that error message. But it doesn't happen often, where you've built too much, too deep a structure. So that made it possible to organize your code in such a way that it didn't have to become like spaghetti hell. I mean, Fortran, how did Fortran get around the fact that it didn't have structures? Well, we used go-tos and conditionals. So you say, if such and such is true, go to 27. Well, not much more to say there. And now you have to create these blocks of code and make sure that it doesn't ever come in through the top, and make sure there's a go-to at the end of it so that you never flow down to the other, you know. And then you have all the bugs that come from all the go-to craziness. And it was around the time of Algol that Edsger Dijkstra wrote the thing, Go-To's Considered Harmful. And I was an old Fortran, not old, but I was a Fortran programmer at the time, and at the time I was learning Simula, and I thought, well, I can't program without go-tos. And it was very true. I could not program without them, but I quickly learned how to do it. And all these days, my own environment, Frontier, did not have a go-to statement. You couldn't go-to anywhere. So by the time I did that, I no longer considered it. Not putting go-tos in my code. So I went from being someone who resented the fact that I was being told I couldn't use one of the very most basic tools that I use to the point where I would never in a million years use it. So Simula allowed you to create objects and allowed you to create structures of data, right? And then structures of code. And because, and that was huge, just a major, huge difference. And from there, I went all the way down to the machine language with PDP 11 assembly language. And that was a similar revelation for me because when you're programming in assembly language, what you're actually doing is you're programming the machine itself, which I paused to say that, of course, that's not really true. It's just the level below the high-level language, let's put it that way. It's the thing that the high-level language is written in, even though, of course, they aren't written in assembly language. And they weren't then either. But everything, ultimately, is executed by machine language or assembly language, whatever. And underneath that, there's microcode. And underneath that, there are gates. And underneath that, there are electrons. So there's your stack. It's pretty low on the stack, and it gives you incredible power. And it doesn't have the concept of structuring code. So you're all the way, now you're back into go-to land. And it does have an idea of a subroutine. And if I'm not mistaken, Fortran probably had those too. So it wasn't without the ability to do a tiny little bit of structuring. But in assembly language, it's not really, these are not really subroutines, and it's not structured code. Even so, the people who designed the machine language on the PDP-11 had a very good, even deep understanding of machine architecture. And it was a great language for a student to learn how to program machine language. And I had actually dabbled a little bit in machine language, IBM mainframe machine language. And, it was more like Fortran in that these were the first languages or very early languages. And they evolved badly because of that, because early decisions were made that were hard to support as time went by. Whereas PDP-11 assembly language was built by people who had already been through this loop a couple of times. And so it had what was called orthogonality, which meant that basically you could put any kind of operand anywhere you wanted. So if you had a value in a register, the add instruction could understand that, or you could give it a memory location. Or it could be moving from a register to a memory location, or from a memory location to a register. You could just do whatever you wanted to do, and it would work, because the instruction set was designed to make that work. And if you actually went in and looked to see how the instruction set was built, you could see that these people, they truly understood it. And that was the most interesting thing, that it was really the first time I saw software that was under control, that was created by people and shipped in this form by people who understood what they were doing and didn't get overwhelmed by it, and made something that stood up under analysis by a student programmer, which is what I was at the time. And so then I moved on to C. And guess what? Same experience. Here's a high-level language that's designed by people who actually really understood the full problem at the moment that they started. They had been through, I don't know the history. Had they been through Fortran or BASIC or PL1 or, well, who knows what languages they had been through before. But by that time they were sitting down to do C, they weren't guessing anymore. They understood what they needed. And it's this magic combination of high-level language and assembly language. So C was the kind of language where you had all of the power of assembly language. Really, there was nothing you couldn't do at a very, sort of machine level, right? But it also had all of the structuring capabilities of high-level language. So you could make compound statements. An if could contain a while loop, and then inside that you could have an if, and inside that a procedure call, and etc. Any combination of things that you wanted. used a mod. Basically, how could they do that? Because they used a modern compiler, and they also gave you the source code for the compiler, and they gave you the source code for the operating system and for the editors. And for a person who had at that point already knew that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, they were giving me the keys to the city. Here it is. Laid it all out for you. And that was the other thing that was brilliant about C, is that C wasn't just a high-level language. It was also an operating system. And so you kept looking to see, well, where's the operating system? And it basically was just a set of libraries that C called. And the command shell was just another C application that made calls like any other application could. And you had the source code, so if you ever wanted to see how that worked or crib some code, you had it. There it was. And when you looked inside the code, and this is the moment at which it just completely clicked for me. When you go look inside the code for the Unix operating system, it reads like pseudocode. It reads like the code you write when you're designing an application. So I'm just trying to lay out the high level map of how all of the components fit together. Well, in the source code of the operating system and in the source code of the language, when you finally get down to the point, the core of it, which would be the kernel of the operating system or the code generator in the compiler or the parser in the compiler or any number of different components that are important in terms of the scheduler in the operating system would be another example, that the code had this kind of, wow, how could it possibly be that simple? How did they do that? My code didn't look like that. My code was, incomprehensible to me the first time I wrote it. But what was so important about it for me was I saw that it could be done. Here is a piece of software that's being used by like all the cool people. That's the way I saw it in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, maybe 1978 or so. That all the cool people are doing this. They're in programming in C, and they're hacking on Unix, and we're having the fucking time of our life. And at the same time, these guys have mastered something that I have not yet mastered, but I know it can be done. And I know what it will look like when I get there. So I guess that's the point I wanted to make, is that from there I proceeded to iterate and hack and learn. And also I tried to move higher up the stack because I wanted to make software for literate people, not just for geeks. And so I had an ambition that was not built into C, certainly, and nor was it built into Unix. Even to this day, Unix doesn't make any compromises for what I call poets, people whose programming language is English. But those were the people that I... that was my mission. You see, there was another mission here. But all I want to talk about today is the programming. Just mention that there are poets out there, and there are people out there that can benefit from this stuff. And Unix was a necessary place for all of us to gather before. And I feel like David McCullough almost at this point. It was a necessary place for all of us to gather before we would all go our separate ways. And you can see all of the ideas of Unix in the Macintosh OS. And it's really brilliant how it all ended up there in the operating system in the Macintosh. Maybe the people who did, maybe WAS never programmed in Unix. It's possible, because it wasn't there in the Apple II. It had its own charms that you didn't get on Unix. And maybe that's a story for a different day. To give you a preview, the story there was direct memory access. I could direct screen memory access. So if I wanted to put a character on the screen, I just go to a memory location, put a value in there, and it appears on the screen. Now, that was something you didn't do on Unix. Unix, the terminal, was very far away. Very far away. And on the Apple II, the computer was the terminal. Big difference. Huge difference. But the Apple II didn't feel like Unix on the inside. But the Mac did. So the people who were doing the Mac kernel, the OS there, it didn't feel that way from day one. It had to evolve. But it evolved well. It also had a good foundation when it started, and you know, it had decent continuity, meaning that apps generally tended to be fairly easy to evolve to the next generation of the OS and so on and so forth. I've stopped trying to be on that train for a long number of years, so I don't know how they're doing now. But anyway, that's my story. Thanks for listening. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.